the one man walking toward the camera, and in the back, what looks to be the top of a submarine that has just come through several feet of ice, according to the caption. There is an American flag flying on a post on this submarine top. There's a man standing on the piece that has come up, and three other men who are milling around below it. And this is a training session, apparently, to see how the Pentagon is training for a potential war below the frozen sea. And then another photograph looks to be about a 4x6, also in color. And it's the universities, of course, who are all, or not all, but many of them are protesting the Gaza war. This one is at UCLA, where classes have been canceled because of violent clashes. And this photograph is of one of those clashes. There are tall pieces of what looks to be plywood with writing on them, but they're used more for protection. Lots of students that have masks on, some without, some crouching, some being the aggressors. Not a pretty picture. And then the final photograph, black and white photograph of Paul Auster, who died, and he was a postmodernist writer from Brooklyn. And then on the cover of the Hartford Current, we have a very large 5x7 again, probably, of a photograph of Cynthia Jennings, who is the attorney for Hartford Police Lieutenant Paul West. And we will have that article when we get to the Current. She is speaking before a bank of microphones, looks very angry. Two other women, one looking off to the distance, the other looking down at her phone. And this is at a rally for Mr. West. And then the final picture is of the Collins Axe Factory, built on a river. The factory is in the background, and it's about a conversion of this factory to apartments. And we will also have that story. So to go to the New York Times, the top story, Blinken presses Hamas to accept terms for truce. Secretary of State Anthony J. Blinken delivered twin messages to Hamas and Israel on Wednesday, pressing Hamas to accept a ceasefire proposal while at the same time urging Israeli leaders to put off a major ground invasion into the thickly populated southern Gaza city of Rafah. On the last day of a Middle East trip, his seventh visit to the region since the war began in October, Mr. Blinken tried to turn up the pressure on Hamas. "We are determined to get a ceasefire that brings the hostages home and to get it now. And the only reason that that wouldn't be achieved is because of Hamas," Mr. Blinken said at the start of a meeting in Tel Aviv with Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel. "There is a proposal on the table, and as we've said, no delays, no excuses, the time is now." The proposed agreement calls for the release of 33 hostages in the initial stage of a ceasefire and would lead to the release of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel. Mr. Blinken's comments, which were made in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, were part of a concerted campaign by the Biden administration to secure a pause in a war that, Gazan officials say, has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians. The bloodshed has roiled American campuses and is seeping into domestic politics. Mr. Blinken also made clear that he expected more from Israel. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday night after a day of meetings with Israeli leaders, including nearly 3 hours with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Mr. Blinken said that the Israelis had not convinced him that they can prevent the humanitarian catastrophe that is feared should there be a ground invasion of Rafah. "We cannot, will not support a major military operation in Rafah absent an effective plan to make sure that civilians are not harmed. And no, we've not seen such a plan," Mr. Blinken told reporters. There are other ways, and in our judgment, better ways, of dealing with the real ongoing challenge of Hamas that does not involve, require, a major military operation. Mr. Blinken's visit to the Middle East, which began on Monday, came as Israel is both softening some of its demands in negotiations over a ceasefire and digging in on its vow to move into Rafah with or without a deal, and that's in quotes, as Mr. Netanyahu put it earlier this week. In its latest proposal, Israel said it would ease travel back to northern Gaza for Palestinian civilians uprooted by its assault, according to two Israeli officials. That is a sharp reversal on an issue that has been a sticking point in the talks. For weeks, Israel had demanded that it be able to impose significant restrictions on Palestinians heading to the north, out of concern that Hamas, which set off the war with its deadly October 7th attack on Israel, could take advantage of a large-scale return to re-strengthen itself. Fed declining to ease rates, citing inflation. Federal Reserve officials left interest rates unchanged and signaled that they were wary about how stubborn inflation was proving, paving the way for a longer period of high borrowing costs. The Fed held rates steady at 5.3% on Wednesday, leaving them at a more than two-decade high, where they have been set since July. Central bankers reiterated that they needed greater confidence, and that's in quotes, that inflation was coming down before reducing them. Readings on inflation have come in above expectations, Jerome H. Powell, the Fed chair, said at a news conference after the release of the central bank's rate decision. The Fed stands at a complicated economic juncture. After months of rapid cooling, inflation has proved surprisingly sticky in early 2024. The Fed's preferred inflation index has made little progress since December, and although it is down sharply from its 7.1% high in 2022, its current 2.7% is still well above the Fed's 2% goal. That calls into question how soon and how much officials will be able to reduce interest rates. What we've said is that we need to be more confident that inflation is coming down sufficiently and sustainably before cutting rates, Mr. Powell said. It appears that it's going to take longer for us to reach that point of confidence. The Fed raised interest rates quickly between early 2022 and the summer of 2023, hoping to slow the economy by tamping down demand, which would in turn help to wrestle inflation under control. Higher Fed rates trickle through financial markets to push up mortgage, credit card, and business loan rates, which can cool both consumption and company expansions over time. But Fed policymakers stopped raising rates last year because inflation had begun to come down and the economy appeared to be cooling, making them confident that they had done enough. They have held rates steady for six straight meetings, and as recently as March, they had expected to make three interest rate cuts in 2024. Now, though, inflation's recent staying power has made that look less likely. Many economists have begun to push back their expectations for when rate reductions will begin, and investors now expect only one or two cuts this year. Arizona repeals 1864 abortion ban as two Republicans cross aisle. Arizona lawmakers voted on Wednesday to repeal an abortion ban that first became law when Abraham Lincoln was president and a half century before women won the right to vote. A bill to repeal the law passed, 16-14, in the Republican-controlled state Senate with the support of every Democratic senator and two Republicans who broke with anti-abortion conservatives who dominate their party. It now goes to Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, who is expected to sign it on Thursday. The vote was the culmination of a fevered effort to repeal the law that has made abortion a central focus of Arizona's politics. "We are standing in a moment of Arizona history," said State Senator Anna Hernandez, a Democrat who called the repeal measure up to a vote on Wednesday. The issue has galvanized Democratic voters and energized a campaign to put an abortion rights ballot measure before Arizona voters in November. On the right, it created a rift between anti-abortion activists who want to keep the law in place and Republican politicians who worry about the political backlash that could be prompted by support of a near-total abortion ban with no exceptions for rape or incest. The 1864 law had gathered dust on the books for decades. But it exploded into an election year flashpoint 3 weeks ago when a 4-2 decision by the state Supreme Court, whose justices are all Republican appointed, said the ban could now be enforced because of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. After the repeal is finalized, abortions in Arizona will be governed by a 2022 law that prohibits the procedure after 15 weeks of pregnancy and makes no exception for rape or incest. But the repeal will not take effect until 90 days after the legislature adjourns for the summer, meaning that the 1864 ban could still end up temporarily derailing abortion access in Arizona if a court allows it to go into effect. Arizona's Democratic Attorney General and Planned Parenthood Arizona have gone to court to keep the law from being implemented. Two Republican state senators, T.J. Shope and Shauna Bolick, joined Democrats on Wednesday to force that repeal bill to a vote over furious attempts by far-right Republicans to block it. Breaking down walls, United Methodists end ban of gay clergy. The United Methodist Church on Wednesday removed its long-standing ban on ordaining gay clergy, formalizing a shift in policy that had already begun in practice and that had prompted the departure of a quarter of its U.S. congregations in recent years. The overturning of the 40-year-old ban on self-avowed practicing homosexuals, and that's in quote, passed overwhelmingly and without debate in a package of measures that had already received strong support at the committee level. Delegates meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, also voted to bar local leaders from penalizing clergy or churches for holding or declining to hold same-sex weddings. The vote effectively allows same-sex marriage in the church for the first time, although the original penalty was unevenly enforced. Some clergy may still decline to perform same-sex weddings. Further votes affirming LGBTQ inclusion in the church are expected before the meeting adjourns on Friday. "We've always been a big tent church where all of God's beloved were fully welcome," said Bishop Tracy Smith Malone, the new president of the denomination's Council of Bishops and the first black woman to serve in that role. She called the vote a celebration of God breaking down walls. She described the atmosphere in the room as a Pentecost moment in which the presence of the Holy Spirit was palpable. Last week, the conference approved the first phase of a regionalization, and that's in quotes, plan that would restructure the global denomination to give different regions autonomy on adapting rules on issues including sexuality. The move is seen as a way to defuse tensions between the increasingly progressive American church and more conservative factions internationally. Though the end of the ban on gay clergy applies to the global church, regionalization means that in practice it may primarily affect churches in the United States. The United Methodist Church is the second largest prominent Protestant denomination in the nation. The Southern Baptist Convention is the biggest. There were 5.4 million Methodists in the United States in 2022, a steep decline from just a few years earlier, and a number that is expected to drop again once last year's accelerated departures are counted. Delegates also voted this week to end a ban on using United Methodist funds to, quote, promote acceptance of homosexuality, end quote, a change particularly welcomed by those in ministries working with LGBTQ people. Green ignores allies and snipes at Johnson. When Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, first dangled the threat of ousting Speaker Mike Johnson, she received a call from a longtime ally and fellow hard-right Republican who urged her not to follow through. "I don't know how this helps us 6 months before an election when we're trying to win the White House," Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, told her, he said in a recent interview. Republicans were in a strong position to win back the Senate, Mr. Jordan said, and former President Donald J. Trump had a decent shot at winning the White House. "The only thing that makes me a little nervous is, could we somehow lose the House?" he told Ms. Greene, adding, "Let's don't make it a chance." Mr. Jordan was far from the only person Ms. Greene respected telling her to stand down. Mr. Trump, who thinks the chaos in the House is harming his reelection chances, publicly vouched for Mr. Johnson as someone doing, quote, "about as good as you're going to do," end quote, and has gently pressed Ms. Greene in private to move on, according to people familiar with their conversations who described them on condition of anonymity. Former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who elevated Ms. Greene and turned her into one of his top allies during his abbreviated time in the top post, never criticized her publicly. But privately, he called Mr. Johnson and offered to intervene with her on his behalf, according to people knowledgeable about the exchange. Ultimately, none of it mattered. Ms. Greene could not be controlled, even if her campaign against the Speaker has left her isolated within her party. So on Wednesday morning, wearing a red MAGA cap and standing in front of a blown-up picture of Mr. Johnson embracing Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, and the minority leader, Ms. Greene said she would demand a vote next week to remove Mr. Johnson from the speakership. Mr. Jeffries, she said, had embraced Mr. Johnson with a warm hug and a big wet sloppy kiss, making them the joint leaders of what she refers to disdainfully as the Uniparty. She did so knowing that her effort to depose Mr. Johnson was all but certain to fail. She has only two Republicans publicly committed to backing it, and Democrats have said they would vote to block any motion to oust the Speaker, giving him more than enough votes to kill it. But Ms. Greene has never abided by the conventional rules of politics, where a loss on the House floor is considered a major defeat. Since arriving in Congress 4 years ago, she has played a different game altogether. And now we'll have the national weather forecast before taking a brief break. That forecast: thunderstorms capable of producing hail and damaging winds will stretch from Minnesota and Wisconsin to northern and central Texas and Louisiana today. Downpours may lead to renewed flooding in eastern Texas, northern and central Louisiana, and Arkansas. Farther west, strong winds and dry conditions will lead to an elevated fire risk in New Mexico and far west Texas. High elevation snow and low elevation rain will fall in Montana. Similar conditions are expected into northern Wyoming. A few showers could dampen northern New England. Summer-like heat will continue from the interior middle Atlantic into the southeast, while New England and coastal areas stay much cooler. And now we'll take a brief break. We'll be back with our local forecast and more news from the New York Times.
If you miss one of your favorite Chris programs, log on to our website, chrisradio.org, and click Chris on Demand. Or register to use our telephone reader service. Call 860-527-8000 for more information.
The forecast for this evening is cloudy with a low around 49. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high near 68. Tomorrow evening looks to be mostly cloudy with a low around 45. There's a chance of showers on Saturday. Otherwise, it will be partly sunny with a high near 69. There's also a chance of showers that evening with a low around 46. And on Sunday, showers are likely with a high near 57. Mostly cloudy that evening with a chance of showers, low around 50. Have a great evening, and thanks for listening to Chris.
And now we'll continue with the New York Times and some stories from the business pages. Hey, AI. Some may find it awkward, but let's talk. A pair of glasses from Meta shoots a picture when you say, "Hey, Meta, take a photo." A miniature computer that clips to your shirt, the AI pin, translates foreign language into your native tongue. An artificially intelligent screen features a virtual assistant that you talk to through a microphone. Last year, OpenAI updated its ChatGPT chatbot to respond with spoken words, and recently, Google introduced Gemini, a replacement for its voice assistant on Android phones. Tech companies are betting on a renaissance for voice assistants, many years after most people decided that talking to computers was uncool. Will it work this time? Maybe, but it could take a while. Large swaths of people have still never used voice assistants like Amazon's Alexa, Apple's Siri, and Google's Assistant, and the overwhelming majority of those who do said they never wanted to be seen talking to them in public, according to studies done in the last decade. I, too, and that's the article, the author, Brian X. Chen, I, too, seldom use voice assistants, and in my recent experiment with Meta's glasses, which include a camera and speakers to provide information about your surroundings, I concluded that talking to a computer in front of parents and their children at a zoo was still staggeringly awkward. It made me wonder if this would ever feel normal. Not long ago, talking on the phone with Bluetooth headsets made people look batty. But now, everyone does it. Supplement stores angle to tap into Ozempic boom. As diabetes and weight loss drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy took off in the last few years, many people turned away from established diet and nutrition products. Now, two retailers that specialize in nutritional supplements, GNC and The Vitamin Shop, are trying new approaches to win over people who are taking those drugs or who are interested in them. GNC is dedicating a wall of supplements in its more than 2,300 stores to products that it believes will appeal to people on Ozempic, which contains the compound semaglutide, and other drugs that are known as GLP-1 medicines. The chain is also training workers to help customers assess which substances could help them manage common side effects of those prescription drugs. Michael Costello, chief executive of GNC, said his company saw a big opening, and that's in quotes, in helping individuals taking such drugs for weight loss. As we were looking at the trends with folks, where people are going, Ozempic and obviously Wegovy and other GLP-1s started blowing up, Mr. Costello said in an interview. We saw there were significant side effects for a lot of those drugs. It's not clear exactly how many Americans are taking Ozempic and similar drugs for weight loss, but Mr. Costello referred to a study from Goldman Sachs that estimates up to 70 million Americans will have tried the medicines by 2008. GNC thinks it can expand its weight management category through this push. Currently, less than 10% of GNC's business comes from its weight management products, but recently it said sales in the category have grown more than 20%. UnitedHealth top executives slammed over cyber attack. In a tense Senate hearing on Wednesday, lawmakers sharply criticized UnitedHealth Group's handling of the cyber attack that paralyzed the U.S. healthcare system, citing the failure of its security systems and the potential disclosure of sensitive medical information of millions of Americans. Democratic and Republican senators questioned whether the cyber attack of Change Healthcare, which manages a third of all U.S. patient records and some 15 billion transactions a year, was so vast because UnitedHealth is too deeply embedded in nearly every aspect of the nation's medical care. United Health Group, which reported $372 billion in revenues in 2023 and is one of the nation's largest corporations, is not only the parent of Change, but also the parent of the country's largest health insurer and a big pharmacy benefit manager, Optum Rx. The Change hack is a dire warning about the consequences of, quote, too big to fail, end quote, mega corporations gobbling up larger and larger shares of the healthcare system, said Senator Ron Wyden, the Oregon Democrat who is the chairman of the Finance Committee. The U.S. healthcare system was thrust into chaos after the February 21st attack on Change, which serves as a digital highway between health insurers and hospitals and doctors. Patients could not fill prescriptions, and hospitals and doctors faced a severe cash crunch because they could not be paid for their care. Black entrepreneurs on the fence. Kimberly Jolassen, a 32-year-old entrepreneur in Atlanta, has never voted for the Republican candidate for the presidency. That may be about to change. Her company, Villy, is an online platform that lets new parents share photos and updates about their babies with friends and relatives and register for gifts like strollers and playpens. Not yet profitable, her company needs financing to grow. But venture capitalists struggle with her untraditional profile, she said. Technology is dominated by white men in places like Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas. She is a black woman in Georgia. Banks want to charge her interest as high as 14% for business loans. The interest rate on the credit card debt she used to start the company has spiked to 25%, tripling her monthly payments. Ms. Jolassen knows that borrowing costs are driven by the Federal Reserve. She does not blame President Biden, but she assumes that his Republican opponent, former President Donald J. Trump, is more in tune with the needs of business owners, so she is seriously contemplating giving him her vote. For the first time in my life, the ball's in the air, she said. I haven't made my decision. Despite indications of vigor in the economy, higher borrowing costs are a source of financial anxiety that could prove pivotal in the 2024 presidential election, especially in Georgia, one of six battleground states expected to determine the outcome. Black voters are a crucial bloc in Georgia. And now we'll take a brief break, and we'll be back with news this time from the Hartford Courant.
Hi, I'm Rick Gray, a Chris Radio volunteer. Chris wants you to know that the Connecticut affiliate of the American Diabetes Association provides programs for diabetics, their families, and anyone affected by diabetes. Programs include support services, education, youth activities, public awareness, and professional offerings. Meetings are held throughout the state. For more information, call 800-842-6323. That's 800-842-6323. Or call the state info line at 211.
And we're back with news from the Hartford Courant. Courtney leads new push for second sub. U.S. Representative Joe Courtney has recruited 120 colleagues in his continuing effort to press the White House and Pentagon to fund a second New Virginia-class submarine in the proposed national defense budget. The 2nd District Democrat, an influential voice in naval affairs as ranking member of the Sea Power Subcommittee of the U.S. House Armed Services Committee, obtained the signatures of the bipartisan group on a letter made public Wednesday urging the leadership of the House Appropriations Committee to reverse the Navy's decision to break with recent tradition and pay for one rather than two Virginia-class ships next year. It is a tactic that has worked for Courtney in the past, earning him the nickname Two Sub Joe. 4 years ago, he organized a similar letter and succeeded in restoring a second Virginia submarine that had been cut from the fiscal 2021 defense budget by the administration of former President Donald J. Trump. The Groton-based Electric Boat Division of General Dynamics, located in Courtney's Eastern Connecticut District, is the U.S. Navy's prime submarine contractor and lead shipyard on both the Virginia Attack and Columbia Ballistic Missile submarine programs. The Navy said it needs a dozen Columbias and 66 Virginias to carry out its mission, numbers that could keep shipyards and suppliers operating at old Cold War production rates for decades. Electric Boat is at the top of a submarine manufacturing and supply chain that has been hiring at a furious pace and investing billions of dollars in capacity in an effort to meet the aggressive Navy production goals designed to contain Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific. Electric Boat hired more than 5,000 last year and says it is on track to match that pace far into the future. Courtney argues that by eliminating a submarine, the Navy is sending the wrong message to thousands of companies in the submarine supply chain, locally and across the country, that have been investing in labor, equipment, and material in the expectation of steady naval procurement. We are deeply concerned with the proposal to procure just one Virginia-class submarine in the president's proposed FY 2025 budget, the letter to the committee chair says. Yukon president defends arrests. A day after police arrested 25 pro-Palestinian demonstrators at the University of Connecticut, President Radenka Marek issued a statement that encouraged free expression and dialogue while standing firm in the university's decision to arrest peaceful protesters. The joint statement, authored by Marek, Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs Anne DeLiva, and Vice President for Student Life and Enrollment Nathan First, is the first communication from Marek to the Yukon community after student activists established an encampment on April 25th to demand that the university break ties with Israel and divest from companies supporting the war in Gaza. Yukon dismantled the encampment Tuesday after University of Connecticut police arrested 24 students and one former student during an early morning crackdown. The protesters were charged with criminal trespass in the first degree and disorderly conduct. In the statement, Marek, DeLiva, and First said this was a difficult decision, and that the university, quote, acted to ensure compliance with its policies and practices regarding larger public outdoor gatherings on our campuses, end quote. While we all wish arrests could have been avoided, we are grateful for the largely calm response and hope that this paves the way for constructive dialogue on very serious issues facing the global community in which we all live, which is exactly what a university community should foster, they said. Marek, DeLiva, and First said that the university, quote, unequivocally supports the rights of our students and community at large to express themselves through speech and peaceful assembly, as well as through the bedrock right of academic freedom. They said the encampment was not registered and did not follow the university's policies and processes, and that individuals who were gathered at the encampment significantly deviated from the guidelines and ignored directives to follow them, including by erecting tents and through the use of amplified sound. Student demonstrators said that between 50 and 200 police descended on the encampment at approximately 7:30 a.m. on Tuesday, encircling the camp and arresting students who did not comply with orders to disperse. University spokesperson Stephanie Reitz said Connecticut State Police troopers and a small number of officers from East Hartford, Norwich, Willimantic, and the Department of Corrections assisted Yukon Police. The university did not respond to a request to disclose the total number of law enforcement personnel involved. Hartford BLM alleges bias in selection of police chief. A tiny contingent of Black Lives Matter members protested outside Hartford Police Headquarters Wednesday, proclaiming that the administration is targeting a veteran black police lieutenant because of his race and keeping him out of contention for the chief's job. Protesters portrayed Lieutenant Paul West as the community's choice to lead the department, accused current chief Jason Thodey of waging a vendetta to ruin his career, and called on Mayor Arunan Arulampalam to intervene to save West's job. Paul has definitely been victimized. Paul really wants to be the next chief. He has earned it. He is a great representative for us in the black community, community activist Bridget Prince told reporters at the rally. Paul is educated. He has received 2 advanced degrees from the University of Hartford. Instead of embracing that and allowing it to be a catalyst for young men and women, it's used against him, she said, referring to a charge of conduct unbecoming an officer that is pending against him over an allegation of plagiarism. Former Hartford NAACP President Ula Dodson said Arulampalam should step in and name West as leader of the city's police force. This is supposed to be serving the community, Dodson said. We are the voice. Maybe Paul West can't speak up. We should be the ones to speak on his behalf. We have just elected a new mayor. The mayor should be speaking up. If the community wants this man to be the chief, that's what should happen. But Thodey, on Wednesday afternoon, put out a statement defending his administration's progress in diversifying the department's ranks, and Arulampalam made clear he is not going to try to slow or stop the disciplinary process against West. While there is still much work to be done, we have made great strides in the last 5 years with some of the most diverse recruit classes the department has ever seen, Thodey said. During my time as chief, I have cultivated a command staff that is comprised of 60% minority officers. Arulampalam's office said the city hasn't begun holding the community listening sessions it plans as part of the police chief search process, so now is far too early to talk about making a selection. Iconic Canton factory targeted for condos, apartments, shops. The iconic Collins Company Axe Factory complex in Canton could become home to nearly 290 apartments and condos under a plan by the daughters of long-term property owner Rusty Tilney. Sisters Lisa and Merritt Tilney intend to salvage all of the historically significant buildings that can be saved and will retain the unique patchwork of small canals and industrial waterways that run through the property. The plan could include a brewery, a coffee shop, and wine bar or restaurant, the Tilneys said Tuesday, and would definitely incorporate the numerous small antique shops that operate on part of the property now. Overall, they emphasized that they are committed to retaining the unique character of a nearly 2-century-old former industrial complex of brick and clapboard buildings along the Farmington River in the heart of Collinsville, Canton's art and antiques hub. As an architect, I can say you don't see places like this, and today you can't create something like this, Lisa Tilney said. You have the green, the beautiful church, the Victorian homes. It's eclectic and amazing. But because of the complex nature of the project, the first apartments or condos might not be on the market for another 5 to 6 years, the Tilneys cautioned. The sisters' business, Collinsville Redevelopment Company, is applying for a wetlands permit, the first step in what's anticipated to be a lengthy process of getting approvals to repair some of the canals, replace utilities, and create driveways through the property. Because of the proximity to the Farmington River, the complex project will need to undergo a mix of local, state, and even federal reviews. Environmental issues, from water quality to the state of local fish and wildlife, will all be considered, and the state will be reviewing the traffic impact. The state and local permitting process will take a year to a year and a half or more before environmental cleanup can begin, the Tilneys said. The project will be built in phases, and it's unlikely that tenants could move into the first wave of homes before 2029 or 2030, they said Tuesday. Our intent is to keep as much of the existing fabric as possible while enhancing the site with new infrastructure and eventually renovated buildings, Merritt Tilney said. Our emphasis is on improved connections from Main Street through the site and to the Farmington River, with a series of stairs and accessible ramps, new green space, and new paths to the water. House passes bill broadening definition of anti-Semitism. The House passed legislation Wednesday that would establish a broader definition of anti-Semitism for the Department of Education to enforce anti-discrimination laws, the latest response from lawmakers to a nationwide student protest movement over the Israel-Hamas war. The proposal, which passed 320-91 with some bipartisan support, would codify the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism in Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, a federal anti-discrimination law that bars discrimination based on shared ancestry, ethnic characteristics, or national origin. It now goes to the Senate for a vote. Action on the bill was just the latest reverberation in Congress from the protest movement that has swept university campuses. Republicans in Congress have denounced the protests and demanded action to stop them, thrusting university officials into the center of the charged political debate over Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza. More than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed since the war was launched in October, after Hamas staged a deadly terrorist attack against Israeli citizens. If passed by the Senate and signed into law, the bill would broaden the legal definition of anti-Semitism to include the, quote, targeting of the State of Israel conceived as a Jewish collectivity, end quote. And now we'll take a brief break, and we'll be back with our final segment of today's Front Pages.
Hi, I'm Tricia Beatty, a Chris Radio volunteer. If you need a ride to the store, a doctor's appointment, your job, or just to visit a friend, call Nutmeg Senior Rides. Nutmeg Senior Rides offers 24-hour service every day of the year to seniors and adults with visual impairment in Bloomfield, East Granby, East Windsor, Enfield, Granby, Summers, South Windsor, Suffield, Windsor, and Windsor Locks. This alternative transportation program uses a combination of volunteer and paid drivers who provide rides in private vehicles. There is no restriction on the purpose of a ride, and help is offered to carry packages, fold walkers, and open doors. That's why many feel that using Nutmeg Senior Rides is like riding with a friend. For more information, log on to nutmegseniorrides.org or call Margaret at 860-758-7833. That's 860-758-7833.
And we're back with local Connecticut news. New tours of Mystic Pizza, Adams Family Highlight Series. The Waterbury Palace Theater has announced its 2024-25 Broadway series, and there are some welcome surprises on it, including new national tours of the Addams Family and Mystic Pizza that have not played Connecticut yet. The season opens October 3rd to 6th with Hadestown, the modern musical based on the ancient spring/winter myths of Orpheus and Eurydice, and Hades and Persephone, played the Bushnell in Hartford just over a year ago, and is currently at the Schubert Theater in New Haven this week. The show, written by Anais Mitchell and directed by Rachel Chavkin, is known for letting its cast members reinterpret the main roles rather than adhere to how they were first done in New York, so it's the kind of show that's worth checking out a second or third time. The Addams Family will play at the Palace on January 17th and 18th, 2025. This is a new tour of the 2009 musical with a book by Marshall Brickman and Rick Elise, who wrote Jersey Boys, and music and lyrics by Andrew Lippa. The show ran for over 700 performances on Broadway, had a successful few years of tours, and even had a revival in Chicago just 6 years after first having its pre-Broadway tryout there. As successful as the professional productions have been, the show became a sensation when the performance rights trickled down to high school theater. There have been dozens of amateur productions of the Addams Family in Connecticut alone. This new tour, which has not played Connecticut yet, is a response to that ongoing popularity, as well as the highly rated Netflix series Wednesday, which is based on the same characters created by Charles Addams for cartoons in The New Yorker and the subject of several other TV series and movies. Let me see. Coyne takes helm as Archbishop. Archbishop Christopher Coyne officially succeeded Archbishop Leonard Blair on Wednesday as the spiritual leader of 469,000 Roman Catholics in the Archdiocese of Hartford. After a year of listening and learning the joys and the hopes, the griefs and anxieties of God's people here in Hartford, I am excited to set out with you on this new stage of our journey together as church, Coyne said in a statement. Coyne was named Archbishop Coadjutor on June 25, 2023. He had served as Bishop of the Diocese of Burlington, Vermont, since 2014. Merrick Kukulka, CEO of Catholic Charities, Archdiocese of Hartford, said, Archbishop Coyne has a reputation of being a strong advocate for the Catholic Charities in Vermont, and since he has been in Hartford, I have seen firsthand his commitment to care for the most vulnerable in our communities. As the Human Services Ministry of the Archdiocese, we are eager to support his vision by providing help and creating hope for all people, Kukulka said. As I ask the prayers of all people of goodwill that our work might bear abundant fruit, I pledge to you that I will strive every day to be a faithful image of the Good Shepherd, who welcomes the lost and protects those who struggle, Coyne said. Today, Jesus calls us to be a church that goes out to the changing world around us, and I invite my new family of faith to join me in meeting this moment with a renewed energy for our mission to bring Christ's light, peace, and hope to our families, our neighbors, and everyone in this place we call home, he said. Blair retired upon reaching the mandatory retirement age of 75. He had served for 10 years. Coyne is the 6th Archbishop of Hartford and 14th Bishop of Hartford. The first was Archbishop, the 14th Bishop of Hartford. The Archdiocese includes Hartford, Litchfield, and New Haven counties. A mass to mark the beginning of Coyne's ministry will be held at 11 a.m. Sunday at the Cathedral of St. Joseph, 140 Farmington Avenue in Hartford. In a video address, Bear spoke of his ministry as Archbishop. Life today presents many daunting challenges, especially for the church, he said. I am grateful for the understanding and support of you, our Catholic people, and the collaboration of so many talented individuals, clergy, religious, and laity. Body cam footage shows man shooting. The Connecticut Office of Inspector General released body camera footage and a preliminary report from an officer-involved shooting in Hartford over the weekend that shows an officer opening fire at a man who was shooting a gun in the direction of someone else. Officer Devanand Badhu of the Hartford Police Department was dispatched just after 12:10 a.m. Saturday to Weathersfield Avenue on a report of a hidden hit and run crash. While speaking to the driver, whose vehicle was damaged, Badhu reportedly heard gunshots go off, according to the report released by Inspector General Robert Devlin Jr. Devlin wrote in his report that the gunshots appeared to be coming from the house across the street on Weathersfield Avenue. The footage from Budhu's body camera shows him speaking to a man involved in the crash when two gunshots can be heard, which are then followed by two more rounds of gunfire. Budhu then radios in that, "We got shots fired," at the home, just as a man, later identified as a 30-year-old Hartford man, emerges from the house running, the footage shows. Just a few seconds later, a second man, identified as 34-year-old Hartford resident Luis Ortiz, can be seen exiting the front door of the home in what appears to be in pursuit of the first man, the body cam footage shows. According to Devlin's report, Ortiz was firing shots in his direction. Budhu's body cam footage shows him pointing his firearm in the direction of Ortiz and yelling, "Hey, get down, get down." He then fires two shots toward the direction of Ortiz as the first man drops down to the ground behind a car, the footage shows. No one was struck by gunfire. Badhu then rushes toward the house after Ortiz goes back inside and closes the door, the footage shows. He calls in that he has, quote, a party down, end quote, and gives a description of the suspect as he stands outside the home where voices inside can be heard. The footage also shows Badhu instructing someone else at the scene to check on the first man. The body cam footage cuts off shortly after Budhu says the suspect ran back into the apartment building and that he needs additional units to secure the perimeter. Co-working space opens. To meet growing demand for office space among startups and small businesses, the co-working space of Office Club has opened its doors. Co-working spaces, which are billed as, quote, the modern way of working, end quote, allow workers from different companies to share an office space in one building. The alternative to the more traditional dedicated office, company office, rose in popularity since the pandemic, when remote work became commonplace. Office Club, located at 48 to 54 Main Street, Hartford, now joins a handful of other co-working spaces in Hartford, including Regis at 100 Pearl Street and the Mez Hartford at 20 Church Street to offer spaces for workers. The building, listed at 5,000 square feet of space, offers meeting and conference rooms, larger office suites, modular office space, individual advisor desks for individuals, and lockable mailboxes. Office Club also offers a virtual address of 50 Main Street for LLCs, banking, and building business credit. Sometimes people starting their own company don't want to list their home address, so we offer that privacy for small business owners, said Office Club owner John Valdez. I have a couple of attorneys lined up I have a couple of attorneys lined up to onboard LLCs. So for a person looking to start a business and create an LLC, we will take care of all that in-house, as well as provide you a space to call home. Valdez, a real estate broker that founded his own real estate company, representing All Real Estate LLC, in 2017, said he bought the building to serve as an office space for his own company. And that ends our coverage from the New York Times and the Hartford Current, but we do have a few more items. We have some birthdays for today, May 2nd. Singer Engelbert Humperdinck is 88. Actor-activist Bianca Jagger is 79. Singer-songwriter Larry Gatlin is 76. Actor Christine Baranski is 72. Fashion designer Donatella Versace is 69. Commentator Mika Brzezinski is 57. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb is 56. Wrestler turned actor Dwayne Johnson, also known as The Rock, is 52. Former soccer player David Beckham is 49. Actor Ellie Kemper is 44. Olympic gold medal figure skater Sarah Hughes is 39. NBA All-Star Paul George is 34. And Princess Charlotte of Cambridge is 9. And finally, we have some almanac items for you today. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, the 123rd day of 2024. There are 243 days left in the year. On May 2nd, 1994, Nelson Mandela claimed victory in the wake of South Africa's first democratic elections. President F.W. de Klerk acknowledged defeat. Also on this date, May 2nd, in 1890, the Oklahoma Territory was organized. In 1932, Jack Benny's first radio show, sponsored by Canada Dry, made its debut on the NBC Blue Network. In 1941, General Mills began shipping its new cereal, Cheerios, to 6 test markets. The cereal was later renamed Cheerios. In 1970, jockey Diane Crump became the first woman to ride in the Kentucky Derby. She finished in 15th place aboard Fathom. In 1972, longtime FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover died in Washington at age 77. In 1997, Tony Blair, whose New Labour Party crushed John Major's long-reigning Conservatives in a national election, became, at age 43, Britain's youngest prime minister in 185 years. And then we'll move all the way up to 2022. A draft was leaked of a Supreme Court ruling throwing out the landmark Roe v. Wade abortions rights ruling that had stood for a half century. The court cautioned that the draft was not final. The decision would be released in essentially the same form on June 24th. And that's all for this edition of the Front Pages. I've been reading from today's New York Times and Hartford Current. Your reader is Lodia Vola. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11, and it's available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Welcome to A Cup of Health with CDC. I'm your host, Dr. Kathleen Dooling. If used and maintained properly, contact lenses can be a safe, convenient alternative to glasses. But failure to remove and clean them regularly can result in serious health problems. Dr. Jennifer Cope is with CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. She's joining us today to discuss the importance of proper use and maintenance of contact lenses. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer, how many people in the U.S. wear contact lenses?
There are approximately 45 million contact lens wearers in the United States.
what problems can result from improper use and maintenance of contact lenses?
Well, there are a spectrum of problems that can result if you don't take good care of your contact lenses. Something as simple as irritation and red eyes, to an infection that might require antibiotic eye drops, to more serious infections that can result in permanent eye damage or even vision loss.
Is it okay to sleep while wearing contact lenses?
Contact lens wearers should not sleep or even nap while wearing contact lenses, unless they're wearing lenses that have been prescribed for sleeping by their eye doctor.
Give our listeners some suggestions for proper use and maintenance of contact lenses.
Well, first, as we said, they should really try to avoid sleeping or napping in their contact lenses. They should also not top off the solution in their case, meaning don't add new solution to the old solution that's already in the case without dumping that out and then adding the new solution. Contact lens wearers should also change their case regularly, at least every 3 months or when they start a new bottle of solution.
How often should contact lens wearers visit an eye care professional?
Well, the American Academy of Ophthalmologists recommends that contact lens wearers see their eye doctor at least once a year.
Where can listeners get more information about proper use and maintenance of contact lenses?
Listeners can go to cdc.gov/contactlenses.
Thanks, Jennifer. I've been talking today with Dr. Jennifer Cope about the importance of proper use and maintenance of contact lenses. Lenses should never be worn while sleeping unless prescribed by your eye doctor. In addition, they should be cared for according to directions and stored